Welcome back to the program. On June 6, 1984, on a windswept beach in Normandy, Ronald Reagan marked the 40th anniversary of D-Day with these powerful words.
We're here to mark that day in history when the Allied armies joined in battle to reclaim this continent to liberty. For four long years, much of Europe had been under a terrible shadow. Free nations had fallen. Jews cried out in the camps. Millions cried out for liberation. Europe was enslaved and the world prayed for its rescue. Here in Normandy, the rescue began. Here the Allies stood and fought against tyranny in a giant undertaking unparalleled in human history. We stand on a lonely, windswept point on the northern shore of France. The air is soft, but 40 years ago at this moment, the air was dense with smoke and the cries of men, and the air was filled with the crack of rifle fire and the roar of cannon. At dawn on the morning of the 6th of June, 1944, 225 Rangers jumped off the British landing craft and ran to the bottom of these cliffs. Their mission was one of the most difficult and daring of the invasion, to climb these sheer and desolate cliffs and take out the enemy guns. The Allies had been told that some of the mightiest of these guns were here, and they would be trained on the beaches to stop the Allied advance. The Rangers looked up and saw the enemy soldiers at the edge of the cliffs shooting down at them with machine guns and throwing grenades. And the American Rangers began to climb. They shot rope ladders over the face of these cliffs and began to pull themselves up. When one Ranger fell, another would take his place. When one rope was cut, a Ranger would grab another and begin his climb again. They climbed, shot back, and held their footing. Soon, one by one, the Rangers pulled themselves over the top, and in seizing the firm land at the top of these cliffs, they began to seize back the continent of Europe. 225 came here. After 2 days of fighting, only 90 could still bear arms. Behind me is a memorial that symbolizes the Ranger daggers that were thrust into the top of these cliffs. And before me are the men who put them there. These are the boys of Puente Hope. These are the men who took the cliffs. These are the champions who helped free a continent. And these are the heroes who helped end a war.
Today we're joined by one of our great military historians, a man whose oral histories of war continue to remind us of those who gave the last full measure of their devotion to protect and preserve the nation. Patrick O'Donnell is the author of 7 previous books. He was a historical consultant for DreamWorks on Band of Brothers, and over the past 20 years he's interviewed over 4,000 veterans who fought in America's wars. It is my pleasure to welcome Patrick O'Donnell back to this program to talk about his newest work, Dog Company, The Boys of Puente Hoc, the Rangers who accomplished D-Day's toughest mission and led the way across Europe. Patrick O'Donnell, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Good to have you here. Ronald Reagan's always a tough act to follow.
No doubt. Those words just are unbelievably inspiring and arguably one of President Reagan's greatest speeches.
Who were these 225 guys?
They were, the assault force, the initial assault force that hit Puente Hoc. It was Dog, F, and E Company. My book is obviously about one aspect of those assault companies, Dog Company, who was part of that hit, that the assault force that hit Puente Hoc, but Dog Company actually achieved the mission set out for effectively almost 2 battalions of Rangers.
Specifically what the mission was, what they set out to accomplish.
There were about 25 large guns that were positioned along the Allied beaches, and they were targeted with airstrikes and shore bombardment. But Puente Hoc was the most dangerous because Puente Hoc was positioned directly between Omaha and Utah Beach, and the guns could hit either beach as well as the ships out in the English Channel. So the Allied planners had targeted Puente Hoc as the number one priority mission for the entire invasion. And they suspected that the aerial bombardment, shore bombardment, would neutralize the guns. So they said they knew that men actually would have to be sent ashore to take them out. And the Germans also knew that they were coming, and they fortified Point de Hoc, and it was one of the greatest fortresses in the Allied beaches. There were minefields that basically ringed the entire area. There was barbed wire and bunkers, 20-millimeter guns, as well as 88s and other mortars. It was a total suicide mission, and they weren't really even sure how to take it out. They thought that initially they might be able to do an airdrop behind the lines near Point de Hoc and then sort of come overland. And then they realized that the only way to do it was a direct frontal assault. And not only is this like a Pickett's charge frontal assault directly into machine guns in this case, but you also had to climb a 90-foot cliff under machine gun fire. And, you know, to make it a little bit even more difficult, the Germans ringed the cliff face with, in today's modern parlance or term, IEDs. They suspended old French artillery shells on wires, and they planned to detonate those in the event of an amphibious assault, which they did in some cases. So these Rangers had to scale these 90-foot cliffs under machine gun fire. The Germans threw down grenades, as President Reagan mentioned, and they somehow scaled these cliffs. And my favorite quote is when Colonel Rutter, who led the mission, went back to Point de Hoc with a relative and just looked up at this 90-foot cliff and said, "I still don't believe we did it."
Did anybody believe that it would work?
The men themselves did, because they spent 6 months climbing cliffs around England, and they were climbing 100 to 300-foot cliffs throughout England, and they were doing it, and it's incredible, too. That's an incredible part of the story. They were arguably some of the best-trained troops in the Allied Army. They were scaling these cliffs, and they were doing it without safety harnesses. They were going up in full equipment on just ropes and their bare hands, and they did that for 6 months. Almost every day they would scale the cliffs. So these men were ready to go on D-Day. They sort of knew how to climb a cliff. And one of the most extraordinary stories in the book is how Hermann Stein, who's about 63 years old at the time of President Reagan's speech, the modern-day Special Forces group reenacted the cliff climbing for the president. And Hermann Stein, who was 63, joined them that day and beat them to the top. President Reagan was absolutely ecstatic when he saw it.
You mentioned the aerial bombardment. Why didn't the aerial bombardment do more to soften up the gun positions?
This is before GPS or laser-guided bombs. I mean, in some cases, it would take 1,000 bombers to blow up a single bridge. That's how imprecise aerial bombardment was during World War II. And they literally plastered the top of Point de Hoc. It looked like the surface of the moon. The Germans were also aware that the Allies wanted to take out the guns. So what they did is, instead of the guns being in these bunkered positions on top of Point de Hoc, they moved them about 800 yards inland into an apple orchard and put camouflage nets all over the guns. And the guns were ready to go. The ammunition, everything was set near this apple orchard. And the Allies never, a single bomb never touched the guns in the apple orchard. So they were still intact at the time of the invasion.
To what degree was there a specific plan, and how much of it was improvised by the guys as it went along?
They had a very specific plan. Each person, each ranger had a specific gun that they were going to take out, and then they had people that were... They were providing supporting fire, everything. It was a very elaborate plan. But when they got to the top, it's the very famous scene in The Longest Day revealed that all they saw were these telephone poles inside the gun positions. The movie is misleading in the sense, though, that it doesn't go further and say the guns were just towed a little bit further inland. And two Rangers, Leonard Lamel being the main one, after they fought through a bunch of enemy bunkers and machine gun positions, and this man was wounded on the side by a machine gun bullet that grazed him as he was climbing up the rope to get to the top of Point de Hoc. He found a bunch of large tire treads, and he followed them down a country road. They avoided a number of German patrols, and I'll never forget, he said to me, "Oh my," he's like, "there they, oh my God, there they are." And he saw the guns in the apple orchard, and the men were equipped with something called a thermite grenade, which was basically, it created a very high temperature, over 1,000 degrees of molten kind of metal. Then the grenades were placed on the gears of the guns, and Lamel disabled them that way.
Talk about Lamel, because he plays a very central role in this story of D Company.
Lamel is sort of leadership personified. He was an incredible man. He was a good friend of mine, and he was a quiet, smart, but he just had to say things once and everything, and people would follow him because he was always, he led by example. And I really admired Len, and I respected him, and he was a good friend. And I just can't say enough about the man. He was great in this story of Point de Hoc, but he was also very instrumental in a place called Hill 400 in the Hurricane Forest.
Talk a little bit about that, because even after they got by the guns, this story doesn't end.
No. In fact, it's sort of, this is, the Point de Hoc story is just one element of this book. And it's their war. It's a very Band of Brothers cinematic type story that begins in Fort Meade, Maryland, where the Rangers and Special Operations troops are just beginning in America. And it talks about the formation of the company there and their training through England, moving on to D-Day at Point de Hoc, and then they fight through Europe. I'll never forget one of the veterans that I interviewed for a book called Beyond Valor. Somebody said to him once, were you just at Normandy? And he said, no. It was a very long walk. And the long walk began at Normandy, and it ended all the way in Pilsen, Czechoslovakia. They fought across the continent of Europe, and they fought either marching on foot or riding on trucks or tank or the backs of tanks as they led Patton's army towards the end of the war. But it's their story from Fort Meade all the way through to Czechoslovakia.
Come back to Hill 400 and what that entailed.
Hill 400 is sort of the crescendo in this book. It's the untold story. It's, as these men told me, our longest day was not D-Day. Our longest day was at Hill 400 on December 7, 1944. What happened is the Hurricane Forest was one of the biggest meat grinders in U.S. Army history. It was one of the longest battles in World War II, and it was a battle that never should have taken place. The forest was heavily defended by the Germans and should have been bypassed. Instead, we sent division after division inside the forest when they were just basically ground up like hamburger meat. Casualties were upwards of 75%. We lost almost as many men in the Battle of the Hurricane Forest as we did in Korea. That's how severe this battle was. And each town was heavily contested by the Germans. And there was a key town called Bergstein, where an entire regiment, a tank regiment, tried to seize the town. And they took a part of it and held it. And they were holding on by their fingernails. One combat veteran in that group said, if daylight didn't come within 30 minutes, we would have lost the town. That's how close it was. Because the Germans realized that Bergstein was important because Hill 400, which is this large hill right outside of Bergstein, overlooked the assembly areas for the Battle of the Bulge, which at the time had not taken place. And Hitler had been assembling tanks, men, artillery for this massive surprise offensive on December 16th. Hill 400 is on December 7th. It's roughly 12 days or 10 days or so before the breakout of the Battle of the Bulge. And Hitler wanted, the German high command realized that Hill 400 was the most important hill in all of Germany. And this was the furthest penetration into Germany at the time. And they threw everything they had on Bergstein. And the Allies had one unit in reserve, and that was the 2nd Ranger Battalion. That was it. And they committed Dog Company and the 2nd Ranger Battalion into clearing Bergstein and seizing Hill 400. And it's an unbelievable story. They get to the town, and they clear it out. The town is every single, it looks like Stalingrad. Every house is bombed out. There's water in the basements. The Germans are fighting hand-to-hand with Panzerfausts and machine guns in each one of these houses. And they, at 7:30 in the morning, they have to seize Hill 400. And the problem is they have to go across an open field to do it. It looks like a football field. It's almost 100 yards long. And on the other side of the football field, and sort of the end zone, if you will, is all kinds of German machine gun nests and bunkers. And so somehow the Rangers have to go across this icy field, seize those bunkers, and then climb a 1,200-foot hill that's 400 meters high. And it's that difficult. So there's a dramatic scene in the book where the Allies are bombing Hill 400 from their backs, and the Germans are bombing them from the front. And this barrage, this creeping barrage, is coming down right on the Rangers, who are behind a sort of a sunken road that overlooks this icy field. And the artillery is coming down on both sides, and it's about to converge on the sunken road where Dog Company and the rest of the Rangers are at. And there's a scene in the book that's just unbelievable. One of the officers orders a scout onto the open field, and everybody knows that is a completely idiotic move that's going to lead to that man's death. But what it does is it creates an interesting sort of like wrinkle in time that changed sort of the entire charge. They were supposed to go at 7:30. They order the scout out. Everybody says, don't do it, don't do it. And the man is told it's a direct order. And he stumbles across the field and is shot in the stomach. It enrages every one of the Rangers in Dog Company. And they basically begin the charge about 30 seconds before they're supposed to jump off. And it saves all of their lives because they go in like almost a perfect window of where the artillery is falling mostly on the Germans and not on the field. And as they rush across the field with their bayonets out and they're firing from the hip, they uncork kind of a Civil War rebel yell, and they descend on these machine gun positions, and they bayonet a number of the Germans. They take some of them prisoner. Some of the Germans run for their lives up the top of the hill, and these Rangers are following them at a high rate of speed. And Lamel's one of those men, and they seize an artillery bunker on top of the hill, a pillbox, which becomes the critical sort of part of the terrain because it's the only place that many of the men can get shelter. They also try to dig some foxholes, which is practically impossible because the ground is so frozen and it's filled with tree roots and everything else. And then what happens next is the Germans shell the hill relentlessly, which, as Len Lamel said to me, picture being in a rainstorm, but instead of water, it was all shrapnel. It was shrapnel for almost 2 days coming down. Men were getting killed left and right. And then on top of that, the Germans were counterattacking. They launched about 5 or 6 counterattacks. And the Rangers at the time only had about 45 or 50 men on top of that hill because the rest were either killed or wounded from the bayonet charge and the fighting.
How many did they have at the start?
They had roughly about 160 men, and their numbers kept dwindling down, and they just lost men left and right, and then the Germans counterattacked, and they were counterattacking in sometimes hundreds of men in company's strength, basically, trying to seize the hill, and they employed sort of a strategy of waiting to see where the counterattack was coming from, and then they would redeploy their men based on that attack, and they would put the men on the hill wherever the attack was coming from, and they fought it off. It was unbelievable. I mean, there's a scene in the book where one man picks up, it's right out of Where Eagles Dare, where almost like Clint Eastwood in that movie picked up two MP40 machine pistols. One of the men in the book in Dog Company, Edward Secor, picked up two MG42 machine guns and fired with both of his hands at the incoming Germans and stopped the entire attack.
One of the things about this that's so remarkable is, I mean, as you describe it and make reference to movies and other stories and talk about scenes in the book, it has this almost artificial cinematic quality, and it's easy to forget the reality of it all.
Every single sentence and word in the book is true. It's based on the documents that were created at the time, or through oral histories that were verified through the documents and other oral histories. And my job as the author was to take all these shards of information and then build a mosaic that was cinematic. And that was the hard part. But it's what I was hoping to accomplish was to bring their story to life.
Talk about, besides Lamel, others that you talked to about this.
Well, I think one of my favorite characters in the book was a guy named Bill Petty. And Petty was they described him as a pain in the ass to authority. He sort of despised authority, but he was a great soldier, arguably one of the best soldiers in the book. Killed 30 men on D-Day, for instance, led a desperate rear guard that allowed many of his men to escape. But what makes Petty the most amazing soldier in the book in many ways is his humanity and his the way that he conveys the feelings and emotions of war. He's just a real character at first. He's a failed paratrooper. He jumps out of a plane on his practice jumps, and he breaks both legs, so he kind of walks around like a crab. He lost his front teeth in a bar fight, and he was almost disqualified from the Rangers because there was a physical requirement that you have your teeth. And they said, you know, you're out. You can't participate because you don't have your teeth. And he's like, who's in charge? I want to talk to him. So, very gutsy move. He goes right to the commanding officer, Colonel Rutter, and said, hey, I don't have my teeth, but I'm not here to bite the Germans. I'm here to fight the Germans. And they goes, all right, fine, you're in. And he turns out to be a great soldier. But what's just amazing about the man is that he was abused as a child by his father, but he sort of takes on a fatherly figure to many of the men in the book who come to he's scared too, but they sort of come to him in many ways and say, look, I don't think I'm going to make it. And he says, it's going to be all right. And one soldier in particular, they're on the ship right before D-Day, and the guy's like, he has a premonition that he's going to die. And Petty tells him that he's going to survive D-Day, and he does. But he dies in his arms. This soldier dies in Petty's arms on Hill 400. And there's just so many gripping scenes like that that this man describes that really makes it very personal.
Talk a little bit about the long-term impact of all of this on these guys that survived, the ones that you talk to. We hear so much today about the long-term effect, PTSD, etc. Talk about how these guys dealt with these remarkable stories.
Each one of these Rangers sort of dealt with it in their own way. it all impacted them, but it impacted them in different ways and different manners. For instance, Len Lamel, it didn't impact him in a negative way. He looked at the things that he got from that experience as a means of strengthening who he was as a person. Other men, they weren't so lucky. For instance, Robert Fruling, who was a radio operator, Len Lamel, ended his life the day that Ronald Reagan gave this great speech on the 40th anniversary of Point to Hawk. So the book captures those stories. And then another main character of the book, Bill Hoffman, had shell shock or PTSD so bad that he was hit by a shell and his eyes were wide open, but he couldn't talk for 2 days. And he doesn't even remember any of that memory because it was so traumatic. And then it happened again where he was basically out for 2 or 3 days. And as he woke up, it's a very dramatic scene. He woke up and he saw a German soldier looking down on him as sunlight was sort of creeping in the doors in an ambulance. And he thought he was captured, but what it was a German orderly that had been a prisoner of war that had been pressed into service by the Allies to take care of wounded Allied soldiers. And it's interesting story that Hoffman received his Purple Heart from Lamar Alexander in March this year for that incident.
How did these guys that were still around feel about Reagan's speech?
Oh, they were that speech. They loved President Reagan, and they loved that speech. That speech was a seminal speech because it brought the past into the present. It made what the efforts of these World War II veterans understandable to the present. It introduced the American people back to the World War II generation, I think. It was a breakthrough speech, and the men were very, very grateful for what the president did that day in honoring them. And then in doing so, he kind of honored all World War II veterans.
And how many of them are still around today?
Well, there were 68 men in Dog Company, and then with replacements, there were many more. But sadly, there's only 5 men left now.
Patrick O'Donnell. The book is Dog Company, The Boys of Point to Hoc, The Rangers Who Accomplished D-Day's Toughest Mission and Led the Way Across Europe. Patrick, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.